Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 12, 2016. The time is 1:35 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, always on time. Representative Sadler, Thompson, myself, Representative Nguyen, Guttenberg, Edgman will be here shortly. Representative Munoz, Representative Garris in the back. I do expect the other members shortly. Today we're going to hear a presentation on pension obligation bonds. Pension obligation bonds have not been sold by the department at this time. Today's presentation is to give the Finance Committee information on whether we want to go down this path or not. So today we have presenting Department of Revenue, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, and Treasury Division, Department of Revenue, Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. Jerry. And members, just go ahead and ask questions as we go through the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is, for the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue, and with me is Devin Mitchell, who is the Executive Director of the Municipal Bond Bank, the State Debt Manager, and he will be staff to the Pension Obligation Bond Corporation. We're going to take this presentation in a couple of parts. I'm going to talk about how we got to where we are, and then Mr. Mitchell will go on and talk about specifics of structuring bond sales. Just start out a little overview. The state manages the two major pension systems, the public employee retirement system, PERS, and teachers retirement system, TERS. PERS and TERS systems provide retirement benefits for most public employees and teachers in the state of Alaska. So 160 state and local employers participate in PERS and 60 state and local education entities, school district, and TERS. By statute, the state is obligated to consider appropriating amounts to support the PERS and TERS pension liabilities in excess of the employer-paid rates. Between 1999 and 2001, PERS and TERS went from being overfunded to carrying unfunded assumed actuarial liabilities. How are PERS and TERS funded? They're both are pre-funded systems. They're both joint systems where the liabilities and assets are held jointly for the participants in the systems, employers. As a retirement benefit liabilities accrue payments intended to satisfy those benefits, they're deposited into a trust. Employers and employees pay on PERS, it goes into the trust. Payments are based on an actuarial analysis, which includes many assumptions, including employment patterns, future wages, life expectancies, health care costs, and investment rate, return rate of currently 8% on the payments. The actual experience, yes?
Is the fund been able to make 8% recently? Where did we end up last year?
Mr. Chair, in fiscal year 2015, the PERS and TERS systems earned about 3.2%. In 2014, the rate was much higher than 8%. Over the life of the system, they've earned in excess of 8%. But we do have periods of time and individual years when the investment results are certainly below the expectations. But over a long period of time, it comes out to being in excess of the 8%.
Mr. Mitchell, working with Wall Street, do you have any vision of, I know it's pretty hard to predict what's going to go on, but we've seen a real downturn recently in the markets. How long do we expect that to go on? Do you have any, you have to consider that. I'm sure you look at that all the time in trying to come up with that assumption. Can you kind of inform the committee of your thoughts on that, of where that may be headed?
For the record, Devin Mitchell.
You are the top guy. You're supposed to know this stuff.
I'm the debt manager for the state of Alaska. I don't usually invest large sums of money. I am responsible for borrowing money, which is a little bit different, although somewhat similar to fixed income investing. And so as far as my views on the national or international equity markets and fixed income markets, I'm probably not the right person to ask as far as the retirement systems go. We have a chief investment officer, Gary Bader. We have other investment officer professionals within the Department of Revenue that would be much better suited to provide you their opinions. And our consultant, Callan, we use Callan Consultants for the retirement systems and their views on the short, intermediate, and long term.
Maybe we'll just bring those back, those folks back in front of the committee. I think that'd be good information. Representative Munoz, followed by Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Following your question on rate of return, with the assumed rate of return on the defined benefit plans, have you had to recalculate that assumption because the plans are getting smaller? Because that as the plans get smaller and the cash needs get greater, because of the smaller pool of people paying into those plans, do you assume a different calculation?
Through the chair to Representative Munoz. The concern you have with a closed plan, which our plans have been closed since 2007, is that as you get to a point where earnings are more important than the deposits into the fund, then you have cash needs that exceed the liquidity that you can provide with an asset allocation that provides an 8% return. There's been an analysis done of that. Gary Bader, our chief investment officer for Treasury, who is also the chief investment officer for the ARM board, and so responsible for the retirement funds, had estimated that we would get to a point where that was a problem early in the 2020s, prior to the legislature making the $3 billion deposit into the funds. At this point, it's pushed out longer than that, but the more the funds are the liability relative to the funding of the funds, so the percentage of the liability that's pre-funded, the lower that is, the more of a the sooner that problem occurs. And then you have a situation where you're not only paying, you're going to have to ratchet down that return assumption in the future on a closed plan. But I think we're out fairly far in the future at this time still. And we can see if we've done any new analysis on that. The retirement board does, in fact, revisit this issue on a regular basis. They're meeting next week in Juneau.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just, I'm sorry I need this, but every year I forget the numbers. Can you give us what you consider the PERS and the TERS shortfall? And do you measure that, are you measuring that based on it being 100% funded for all employees in the system and retired, or 80%, or what portion? So for each, and then how you measure that shortfall, like what employees are you considering?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, when an actuarial analysis is done of a pre-funded retirement system, it's looking at existing employees who are paying into the system, it's looking at retirees, it's looking at the whole universe, and so the what you're trying to do is get a level where, with the ongoing payments today, if everything stopped and you earned 8%, you have sufficient assets to meet your future liabilities for all the employees who are in the system and will be receiving benefits.
Through the chair.
Representative Gary.
So you're measuring at as what we need to pay to have to be able to pay 100% of the retirement obligations due to all our retired people and all of our current workers, assuming they quit today.
Right. It's a point in, it's always going to be a point in time. It's done on an annual basis at fiscal year end, lagged back a year, typically when they do it, and then that's used for setting rates ongoing and the contribution required by the state in excess of the rates paid by employees.
And then just the amount. So if under that assumption, and I think many of us think that assumption might be overly more than we need, but under that assumption, what's the projected debt for PERS and for TERS right now?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, as of the latest evaluation, which is 6/30/2014, the unfunded liability for PERS was $6,252,000,000, and for TERS it was $3,822,000,000. That's as of 6/30/2014, and as you recall, in 2014 session, the legislature appropriated $3 billion, $2 billion of which went into TERS and $1 billion into PERS. So those numbers are definitely different today than they were at that point. They're lower because we had lower returns last year, and they're higher because you put additional contributions in beyond what the actuarial assumed contribution rate is.
Thanks. Madam Fisher, do you not have newer numbers than June 2014?
Through the chair to Representative Guerra, we actually have seen draft numbers for that are for 6/30/2015 that have been presented to the Department of Administration and the Department of Revenue for, and they've gone to from Buck, our standard actuary, to Gabriel Rodersmith, our review actuary, for review, and then they'll go to the ARM board. Part of our presentation on pension obligation bonds and sizing of a deal is assuming that those draft numbers are close to being correct, so we may be talking a little bit about what those are, but they haven't gone to the retirement board, hasn't seen them. The Commissioner of Revenue, the Commissioner of Administration have seen them. We've seen them. They're not, they're still in draft and they're not fully reviewed.
So, Mr. Burnett, I'm you kind of be skating around this, so can you present those numbers to the committee? I know that they're draft.
We don't have those specific numbers with us, but I would think we can talk about the realm of which they are, and we will be getting those to you as soon as we can. Right. I will need that before we get to a point of actually issuing pension obligation bonds or you've taken final action on the budget, clearly. But until they're reviewed by the second actuary, it's we'll probably give you a number fairly close to what they are. I'd love to give you the real number.
And if we're looking at this and
right.
We're trying to ask what the numbers are, and you're telling us, I don't know, maybe we should just do this in next year.
Mr. Chair, I understand where you're coming from there, and I say I don't have the specific numbers with him, and Devin's actually spent, Mr. Mitchell has spent a bit more time with them, and he's free to talk about what we've seen in the draft, and we'll get them to you as soon as we can.
Well, here's what we found out so far. You can't tell us any idea what you think the stock market's going to look like. You can't tell us how much money you saved. You can't tell us how much money you're going to save. And you were prepared for today's meeting.
Oh, and they can't tell us what we owe, which is the problem. That's even worse.
Thank you, Representative Guerra.
Mr. Chair, so the difficulty is that those numbers are not normally released until the ARM board has had a chance to review them, and so they are unofficial draft numbers, and they are normally not disseminated to anyone. Because of the unique situation we're in right now with the governor including in his budget a proposal to use POBs, we've been given limited access to numbers with the specific requirement that we weren't to divulge them to third parties. It is a unique situation. That's where I'm at. Jerry's been given additional leeway on the matter to, and we did include the calculations that we would use for sizing of POB in the presentation that's before you today, but weren't planning to go through what is a draft report of the actuary of the Department of Administration and the retirement system.
You did ask that? Mr. Chair, I would love to give you those numbers. They haven't been reviewed. Can we give you those numbers separately? Yes. And we will get those numbers to you. But we're going to, what we would intend to do today was talk about the sizing of a deal without the very specific numbers, because those numbers could and will change. The numbers in your budget were based on the six, that were in the governor's budget were based on the 6/30/14 valuation.
I mean, that's just.
And they have been that way in each year. They've been lagged back a year. What we'd like to do is get out ahead of that because of the unique issue with having made a big deposit in 2015. So.
Better just stop right now. Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not the first presentation we've had on some of these changes where it seems like there's just like no one's ready to talk about it. I mean, I really actually have a question. That's why I originally raised, but this has been a little bit frustrating these last few minutes. You got to understand, you're asking us to make substantial, we're talking billions. We're not talking hundreds of thousands, we're talking billions of dollars. And you're telling us we have to make these decisions based on lack of information. And this isn't the first presentation we've had where this discussion. So the maybe part of the question is should we move into an executive session so that we can be revealed, so some of this stuff can be brought forward to us? Because ultimately, and this is what happened, I think, a couple last week, there was a presentation, and I think everyone got turned off in this committee for the most part because it was just not it did not give the information that was necessary. And you got it, there's no camera here. No one's doing anything for a camera. This is just a little bit frustrating. But I did want to go back to, and I don't think I'm going to get the answer based on what I've heard, was we've asked for the number. I was curious, what's the percentage of funding? There are certain standards that are utilized in terms of most private companies and private funds. Are we even at the levels that the federal government requires for those types of funds?
Through the chair, from memory, from the draft report, on TERS, and they break it apart for pension and other post-employment benefit, so health care. So health care, we were like 100.6% funded. So we were actually fully funded, which is an awesome story that we can't wait to be able to tell third parties. So we're happy about that. On the pension side in TERS, it was like 78. So the blended rate was like 86%-ish.
Okay.
And so there's, and on the TERS side, again, the OPEB was in the high 90s.
Okay.
And the pension was lower. Maybe it was still in the low 70s, so the blended rate was still in the lower, or in the 70s somewhere. It seems like the high 70s.
So we're within the ranges based on the numbers that you believe are there. We're within the ranges that are usually required for most of these funds. So I guess that then will relay, and maybe you're going to talk about it later. And if you are, please stop me. You can talk about it. How does this having the POBs impact that percentage or that estimate that keeps us, that would, if we were a private entity, keep us in the appropriate levels for terms of what the IRS would require?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, we don't, unlike private sector, we're not under the same rules, okay. Obviously.
And I understand that.
Right. But using the pension obligation bonds would bring the systems up to a funding level we're looking at in the 90% range. So it's much improved. They're already much improved as a result of the legislature's previous action, and this would make them more improved, and it would move the debt to a lower cost, the debt that we have to the to the lower, to the pension system.
Okay. So follow up. So I thank you. I appreciate it. And yes, I do understand that we're different, but we need to make sure that we're holding ourselves to the same standards we'd hold any private industry. But in this case, what you're indicating, and I think it's appropriate, we will increase that. We will put ourselves on a better footing. But there's a secondary discussion, and that is because we've now shifted that the potential burden, weight, whatever, however you want to put it, we've now placed that on the general fund itself, as opposed to it being lying within the funds, because it's now debt. We've kind of shifted it within our systems where that weight is. Are you getting what I'm asking?
I do get what you're asking, and through the chair to represent Pruitt. Under generally accepted accounting practices, the GASB standards under which the state operates, the unfunded liability of the pension systems and the amount paid in excess of the 22%, which is paid as an employer, resides on the state's book as a liability, exactly the same as if we borrowed money. This would not change the state's balance sheet in terms of liabilities and assets. It would simply change that liability from a liability to an investor from a liability to a pension fund, which is operated for the benefit of state and local government employees.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So and just to make sure that I was so, it's really not about does it change how people view our debt. It's really about the policy call of are we willing to take the potential risk essentially of borrowing and making more off of that money. That's truly what it is. It doesn't change
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, I think it's a little, it's almost that, but what we're doing is refinancing debt, which we have to pay currently with an 8% assumed interest rate, because the money that we're replacing when we make a payment on that debt every year, which is all of which is coming out of the general fund for that additional payment beyond the employer rate, we're making that with an 8% rate, and we're pension obligation bonds would be a debt to another party, which would be at a much lower interest rate. So what you're doing is reducing your budgetary costs. This is not really a arbitrage play. It is more like a refinancing play, because this is now a debt on the state's. The difference between a pension obligation bond and the retirement system is that it's more difficult for the legislature to not make a payment in a specific year, because the results of not making a payment are different. One, your unfunded liability goes up. The other one, you defaulting on a loan. So that's the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think I heard something that it's confused me. Let's go back to Representative Garris' original questions when he asked you. How much is currently in the fund itself, if you can tell us?
Right. Roughly, because, again, we've had investment results. We've had other things. So a point in time, we're roughly $15 billion in the PERS fund and roughly $8 billion in the TERS fund, in round numbers.
Basically in the TERS fund, $8 billion?
Approximately. And again, that moves up and down.
If I could finish my question, it'd be nice.
Go ahead.
So the original debt, if it was all cashed in, I believe when other conversations we had, was it $10
billion? Yeah, it's in that range, yes, about $10 billion.
At about 80% funded, it was my understanding from prior conversations that it's looked at as probably one of the best funded retirement systems in the nation.
Mr. Chair, I can't answer that question specifically because, again, other other systems have changed and moved up and down. So it's not one of the most poorly funded, that's for sure. It's not going to be in the bottom.
I'll let the members know the last time we talked to you, the answer was yes.
Well, I don't think it was me that you talked to, but...
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we're at 8%, let's go back to the $3 billion. How much did the actuaries estimate the less money that the state had to put in the last year because we did the $3 billion deposit into TERS and PERS? What would our payments have been if we didn't do that, and what was our payments because we did do that?
Mr. Chair, I don't have those numbers with me, but I believe that number now would be in excess, be around $1 billion this year if you hadn't put that $3 billion in there. So I've looked at it a number of times, but the very specific number, it would be a very large number.
Thank you. That is good. And then thirdly, so if we've got, I'm trying to figure out why you would start out in the hole doing this. If your returns right now are at 3.36% or whatever they were coming back, I believe that's what you mm-hmm. said, and you're expecting 8, I tried to get an answer about what we thought the markets might be for the next year or two, and we couldn't get an answer on that. But I'm certainly not an expert, but my sense is that they're probably not going to increase a whole lot in the next year. So why would you start out at 4 or 5% in the hole right at the beginning? Why wouldn't you wait till it's up there at 8% and then do something like this?
Mr. Chair, the investment results, so if we had done this in 2009 when the market was really well down and funded the system would probably not be underfunded at all right now. Because the stock market had a very long group. We're now at a point where the market has fallen, certainly this year, significantly. And you want to buy when the market's down and not when it's up. So I think we're not proposing to make a timing issue. What we can control is the interest rate, and we have a very low interest rate environment right now. When the legislature passed the bill authorizing pension obligation bonds in 2008, we were looking at interest rates in the 6% range. Now we're looking at interest rates that would be in the 4 to 5% range for the same. So the potential savings in that sense are better now. We didn't make a choice to do these in 2008 for a number of reasons. You may remember the market collapse and actually the inability to borrow money on a subject to appropriation type contract. I think we did finance one project in Alaska with tax exempt financing during that period, and we got an interest rate of 5.9% on a tax exempt. It's the highest rate we've paid since the 80s on a tax exempt issue, and that was the Goose Creek prison. So we weren't borrowing because the law requires us to have to be below a 6.5% when we have an 8% return expectation. So we didn't borrow during that period. Had we been able to, it would have been a very positive thing, especially if we'd invested the money in February of 2009. But we are always looking at the market. The commissioner, the retirement board are always looking at the market, and we would not want to do this when the market's peaking, and we wouldn't want to do it if the market's falling rapidly. We have discretion and timing on a sale.
Not quite sure I heard an answer, but I heard a lot of stuff. I think probably right at the end is your last comment. It was maybe the answer I was looking for.
Okay.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who manages the money, the $15 billion, the $8
billion? Through the chair to Representative Wilson, it's the Alaska Retirement Management Board, which is staffed by the Treasury investment staff.
Follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
So why doesn't the permanent fund Because we're already paying good people to make a lot of money. Why are we duplicating?
Through the chair to Representative Wilson, the Permanent Fund and the Retirement Board and the Treasury Division have different mandates for managing their money. They've been separated. You know, actually, the Department of Revenue used to manage the Permanent Fund. It created a separate corporation to go its own way a number of years ago. And just to be clear, the Retirement Management Board staff, the PERS and TERS have returned, have had a better return than the Permanent Fund 21 of the last 31 years.
So,
I'm not sure. Maybe it would go the other way.
Well, maybe it should. Yeah, Mr. Chair, maybe it should. I mean, if they're doing better than one side and we want better returns, but I guess I'd like to see the numbers on that, because if you guys are making better investments than and on the other side, that's really what's important.
And if I could follow up on that, the Treasury Division and the Retirement Board has 40 currently separate asset allocation and mandates for investment, and each of them has a different results over time. So the Permanent Fund has exactly one mandate for investment, and so they're managed completely differently.
And one last question, just they're not there yet, but thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you could just explain when you get to the last bullet, if you get there, is, you know, how the 22% was determined for TERS and the 12.56, and would there be any other, besides statute change, which I imagine is what it would take, could we change that?
Do you want me to go on? If I can
Yeah, Representative Guerra had a question, but then I'd like to let the gentleman go through their presentation, and maybe a lot of our questions, they do have a lot of good information available, and maybe some of our questions will be answered, but Representative Guerra had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said something that caused me more concern now. So you said you wouldn't do this when the market was peaking, you would do it when the market was soft. We think the market is soft now, though, of course, we have no idea how much further lower it's going to go, so we actually don't know how soft it is. But you wouldn't do it when the market's peaking, but as we now have 2020 hindsight, you were proposing this when the market was peaking, back when the Dow was up at about 18,000. Maybe you didn't think the market was peaking, but that's the risk of all this, isn't it? I mean, you wouldn't do it when the market was peaking, but you were proposing it when the market was peaking.
To the chair, to Representative Guerra, that's an interesting comment, but in fact, when we started looking at this last summer, is in August, when it looked like there was a market correction going on, and then we put everything together, we went through this, and you know, we're not going to invest this money all in one day, and I think there's going to be some timing, just like there was with the $3 billion cash deposit. So we're not market timers. What we can control is how low the interest rate is at the time we borrow money. Make it clear.
Gary, Devin, we're not here to beat you up.
Oh, I appreciate that. Sorry.
When you come to committee and we ask questions and we get a lot of I don't know or we can't talk to you, it tends to cause a lot of frustration. And when you talk over the chair and other members, that doesn't help either.
Okay, sorry. So I think we were looking at where I was at the payments being based on actual analysis, actual experience being reviewed in annual funded status report, which we talked about here. And back to in 2008, so we get to the part where Representative Wilson asked, in 2008, Senate Bill 125 capped PERS employer contribution rate at 22% and TERS employer contribution rate at 12.56 and declared that the state shall make up any difference between 22 and the actually determined contribution rate, made the state the default funding source for additional funding. That was a statutory change. It was a matter of legislative negotiation with the parties. That number is a number. I believe it was based on what the legislature and the administration and local governments believed was feasible at the time. prior to that time, the PERS system was an agent multi-employer system where each employer had their own unfunded liability and their own rate. And there were certain local political subdivisions that actually had rates that could have exceeded 100% of payroll because of things that were outside of their control in most cases. So, but there were a number in the early 2000s, a number of times when actuarial assumptions were changed and updated.
Thank you, Jerry. I would like to recognize we have been joined by Representative Stutz. Welcome. Here to learn more. Thank you.
Okay, so just a little bit of what we've done in the past. 2005, Senate Bill 141 closed PERS and TERS to new employees. 2007, SB 123 created the Alaska Retiree Health Care Trust. 2008, Senate Bill 125 capped PERS employer contribution at 22 and TERS employee contribution at 12.56. And I'd like to go back to the 2007, the Retiree Health Care Trust. One thing unique about Alaska is that we have, as a state, always pre-funded our health care for retirees, which most states don't. We probably have the best, certainly the best funded retiree health care of any state, and have for a number of years. That's going to be required, showing that on the state's balance sheet is going to be required under GASB, I think it's 72, and so it will make the state of Alaska look much better relative to its peers. So 2008, we created the Alaska Pension Obligation Bond Corporation, authorized the issuance of up to $5 billion of pension obligation bonds. 2014, deposited $1 billion in PERS and $2 billion in TERS from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. 2016, we planned an implementation of a POB strategy to diminish growth in the annual increase of the state's appropriation to the systems.
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
Yeah, just real quick on that previous slide. In 2008, and you may have mentioned this earlier and I missed it, did we actually issue the POBs or we just gave the authorization?
Through the chair to represent Pruitt, we have not issued any POBs. The Pension Obligation Corporation has not.
Can I follow up? Do they still have the authority to do it with or without us?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, we do have the authority to do it without. And to be clear, the Pension Obligation Corporation consists of the commissioners of administration, revenue, and commerce. It's analogous to the State Bond Committee, and it has not. It does have the authorization to do without further legislative approval, and the reason that we have not done it without legislative approval is because we would not want to be out there marketing bonds and, you know, hear from a legislator or the chair of a legislative committee that they don't think this is a good idea because these are subject to appropriation bonds and the investors need to have the confidence that the legislative bodies are behind this. This is why we're seeking an appropriation in the current budget bill to do this so that we can provide that additional assurance to investors and hopefully bring the interest rate down even farther than it would be otherwise.
Yeah, thank you.
President Satter. And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Exactly to that point, I'm reading the paper here that says, although a bond sale can occur without legislative approval, I want to say this with a smile, but there is a record of independence on the executive branch's part. Will the executive branch issue these bonds absent clear indication or committed indication from the legislature that they will appropriate to pay them back?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I can't speak for the other members of the Pension Obligation Bond Corporation, but I can tell you that the Department of Revenue, I'm the designee for the commissioner on the Pension Obligation Bond Committee, and I would be incredibly reluctant to issue, to go out to the market with a pension obligation bond when there wasn't a clear indication of support from the legislature. I think it would be not horribly responsible.
follow-ups. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the mechanism for actually making that decision then? You've indicated how you would vote. What is the mechanism for making that full decision on the Pension Obligation Corporation?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, the Pension Obligation Corporation would meet. We would have a resolution prepared to we would see presentations from our staff sitting next to me. And the state's financial advisor, and then the Pension Obligation Corporation would take action on that resolution, yes or no.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Is it a vote?
The chair to represent Sadler, it is, in fact, it would be a recorded voice vote. And we'd have to sign on it, so.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you've had authorization since 08. Is this the first time you've come back with theoretically a request for, thank you, for authorization?
We didn't put it in the
budget. Yeah, through the chair to Representative Guttenberg. In 2008, we were prepared to sell them based on the legislative record or authorizing the legislation. But since then, we have not asked for budgetary authority, nor have we had a specific proposal on the table to do them.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. So in that time, there's been no, you have not perceived that there was no opportunity that would have brought you back to the table.
Through the chair to Representative Guttenberg, we've had some there have been discussions about it, but I have not been in this position through that whole period. I was in this position through part of that period. We've had four commissioners. We've had we're on the third governor since 2008, so it's been discussions. There haven't been choices to make that, and the state's relative financial health has changed over that time. The amount of revenue that we bring in on an annual basis has had significant changes up and down during 2008 to today.
I would add, Mr. Chair, Representative Guttenberg, that the interest rate environment on the borrowing side has relatively recently cratered to the levels that we're seeing right now to raise the interest again in the proposition. So the taxable rates we were looking at for most of that interim were much more on the cusp of, that 6% range, 5.5% to 6.5% range, and really more 6% to 6.5%. So at those levels, it is, from a historical statistical probability perspective, meaning that if you look back in time and you say, how has the stock market performed historically in 20-year time frames, the lower you make your interest rate, as Jerry's referred to earlier, the higher your probability of success in this transaction. And at the 6% range, there's still, a double-digit probability of a 6.5% rate. There's a double-digit probability of not being successful, that is, beating 6.5%. But when you start getting below 5%, you're in the high 90s. And so, again, that isn't a predictor of future performance. The difficulty in predicting future markets is that it's in the future. But it is a good historical indicator of the solid nature of the proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up on that question.
Representative Munoz.
So then, following that line of thinking, then if the rate is 5%, as you mentioned, then the chance for the POMBs not being successful is at roughly 10%?
Through the chair.
Did I understand that analogy correct?
Representative Munoz, no, it would be more like 1%.
1%.
Or less, from a historical probability perspective. Meaning that those 20-year snippets of time in the past, this was a big part of the original bill getting passed. There was a ton of talk, this same talk going on prior to the legislation providing the original authorization being approved by, you know, the same body. And so Brian Andrews, who was deputy commissioner at the time, did a ton of historical analytical analysis to provide these statistical probabilities, and that was a big part of the, I think, people becoming comfortable with the concept, was the high probability of being successful. And just to be clear, I mean, we're already making, we have a pre-funded system that's assuming a rate of 8% is going to be earned. If that rate goes to 7.5%, that unfunded liability that we talked about earlier, it near doubles. And that's a 50 basis point downward shift in our earnings rate. So it's not like we haven't already been making this, this investment in our future. And it's very similar in its nature.
But getting back to my earlier question, though, with the assumed rate of return of 8%, don't you think that's generous given the fact that those are closed plans now and that, you know, future contributions to those plans become more and more limited?
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, as I said before, that is a concern out into the future at some point. But we, the retirement board, regularly looks at their assumed rate using their Callan and Associates as their financial consultant and the actuary, and they have continued to leave the 8% because their financial consultant and that is investment consultant and the actuary have that as being within the reasonable realm. It could be higher, could be lower. We don't know what the future will bring over a long period of time, but if, to Mr. Mitchell's point, if whether or not you do pension obligation bonds, or whether if we don't earn 8% into the future, or we earn much less, the unfunded liability goes up significantly under any scenario where your earnings are much less than the 8%. Significantly. And the pension obligation bonds don't make that problem any worse.
But there is a risk, clearly, right, with pension obligation bonds, and that if they don't go as well as anticipated, then that unfunded liability actually potentially grows.
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, under almost any scenario, unless you're actually losing money in the fund, selling pension obligation bonds isn't going to make the unfunded liability any worse, and it's not even going to make your payments to the unfunded liability any worse. What it's going to do is shift part of your payment on the unfunded liability to an investor, and part of it is still going to be to the fund, because if you don't make your 8% assumed return or whatever your assumed rate of return is, your obligation is going to grow regardless of what happens. And if you don't put more money in, it will grow more in some ways than if you do. So it's an interesting math problem, but the point of looking at pension obligation bonds is to smooth out and reduce the payment that you have to make to pay a debt that exists currently, that you're currently paying at 8%.
But then you,
Representative Munoz?
One final question. Then you go to a hard commitment from a soft commitment, you know, that the liability is a future commitment, right? But then you're transferring that to a commitment that's real.
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, the commitment is just as real either way. The difference is when you absolutely have to make your payments and what the consequences of making your payments are. So we have not had any proposals to sell pension obligation debt for the entire amount of the unfunded liability, because that would harden a liability that's large. So
Mr. Burnett, on point with Representative Munoz's question, and you said payments wouldn't change. But if you started this on the first of the year, and or the fiscal year, and you expect 8%, and you're only getting 3.5% or 4%, at the end of the year, the difference in the payment back into the account, doesn't it have to be made up out of general fund dollars?
To Representative Newman, if whether or not you put this money in the account, that difference has to be made up.
From general fund.
From the general fund. So if you put $1 billion in a fund and you earn 3% on it, then it grew by this, you know, it grew by 3%, you paid 5% interest on it. If you didn't put the money in the account and you earned 3%, your unfunded liability is still going to grow by the difference between the 8 and the 3. So it's not as simple, and it requires an actuarial analysis to look at the payments each year as a result of what happens.
I just thought that discussions that we had there, you know, if you were invested in now and it didn't make the 8%, that the state, we'd have to make that difference in the general fund dollars.
Yeah, exactly. But it's not a matter of whether you do pension obligation bonds or not, because you have to make up whatever the difference is anyway. And in one case, you're paying on an 8%, you're making a payment based on an 8% interest rate to start with, and the other one you're making you're putting money in the account that earns money, and you're making a 5% rate. So it's not that simple, and it is fundamentally different than if the pension fund itself was borrowing money for leverage, because this is the state borrowing money and changing the nature of a liability or who the liability is owed to, rather than it doesn't extinguish the liability, but it puts the money in a different place. And so
I'll understand better at the end of the presentation.
Okay, I hope so.
Thompson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would issuing pension obligation bonds be viewed as an act of desperation by the state addressing its fiscal problems, and could POBs contribute to a rating downgrade?
Through the chair, to Representative Thompson, if you issue POBs to pay your current year payment, it would, and that was a proposal that I saw in a budget last year, which Governor Walker took out when this administration took over, which was, instead of making your actuarially required payment, borrowing the money to do that, that's converting a short-term debt to a long-term debt, and that is not a good thing for the credit rating. If you're converting a long-term debt at 8% to a long-term debt at 5%, that's a credit positive over time. And so we do discuss this with the rating agencies, and, you know, the state has a liability at a certain level. And so if we can pay less on that liability, it tends to be a credit positive over time.
President Thompson.
Thank you. I've got several other questions, but I'm going to hold those until you finish your presentation, because I would like to see the rest of it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Just would it affect the state's ability to bond on any other projects?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe so. In fact, I think it would be actually a help over time.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why didn't we bond in 2008 instead of putting $3 billion more into it?
Through the chair, to Representative Wilson, that was a choice made by the legislature and the administration at that time, and that was in 2014 when you put the $3 billion in. But
let me just rephrase the question then. If we could go back to what would have been the purpose of I know, you know, it's 2014 and we did it, but if this was such a good idea, why would that not have been an option in 2000? I know it was an option, but an option that didn't go forward in 2014 versus taking $3 billion of our savings and now not being able to utilize it now if this is such a great idea.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's a number of different options. The option that was chosen was cash. The state at that time had revenue forecasts that suggested that that would not be a problem. I think the 2014, you know, prior to then, we were looking at to the time that they made this decision, we'd had 2 years of $111 oil, 2 years in a row where it was exactly the same price.
Mr. Chair, maybe this goes to you instead, because that answer makes no sense to me. So, you know, if we're taking money because we can make so much more money off of it and at a lower rate, it seems like that should be a good option every year before we remove money out of somewhere else that we're making money from, $3 billion. So, I mean, just, I know we made a different choice, but it would just seem that somebody would have been pushing and saying, you know, instead of using our savings, even though it was $100 a barrel, if we can make more money than what we're borrowing off of, that should always have been something that would have made more sense at the time, unless we're not getting the whole story.
Well, through the chair to Representative Wilson, I think we're going to give you the whole story. But the interest, as Mr. Mitchell suggested earlier, the interest rates that we could borrow at were not as favorable then as they are now.
Do you know what they were in 2008? Oh, through the chair, do you know what they were in 2008? Because I think that's when the stock market really had some issues.
What's that? Go ahead.
I think it was pretty low.
Through the chair, in 2014, interest rates on the taxable side for entities like the state of Alaska weren't as low as they are now. I don't know exactly what they were, but
2008.
Oh, 2008?
Well,
going back to 2008, we were looking at an interest rate like in a 6.5 range. And then what happened in late 2008, as Jerry said, I mean, Lehman Brothers went out of business. Bank of America Merrill Lynch was purchased. You saw the big bailout occur from the federal government. You could not sell bonds like these in the market at all for a period of time. And then for a period of time, we blew through that 6.5% threshold. We have a hard cap built into the legislation. We cannot borrow unless we can beat 6.5% as our cost of capital. And we could not do that at that time, even though, as Jerry said, if we would have reinvested when the market was crushed after what happened in late 2008, in early 2009, the returns that people have enjoyed that invested in that time frame have been enough that it would have outperformed a high cost even. As Jerry said earlier, it's all we can do is control interest rate. And then we can try to make informed decisions on the reinvestment of the money to ensure that we don't take unnecessary risk. And then we have a 20-year time frame we have to wait for it to go by. And then we'll look back and we'll go, oh, that was either a good decision or it wasn't. And if it wasn't, we're going to have a lot of other hard choices to make, because our underfunding status is going to be severely worse. Because if we didn't make 5% on our invested assets in the trusts, it's going to be significant, as Jerry said.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
This just feels like deja vu of 2014. I mean, we were pretty much told if we didn't put the $3 billion in, we were going to be doing almost what it sounds like we're doing now. I don't know why we weren't given, why the option wasn't brought forward in 2014 on the pension bonds, but I guess I don't know what we could do as a committee besides go through this, but see if there's other alternatives, again, that maybe we haven't been told of before we go forward with more debt. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Edgman had a question. I'd like to try and get through a little bit more of the presentation, too. But I do think it's been a good discussion to help get some baseline, basic information on pension obligation bonds that the members understand better. Representative Edgman.
Yeah, it just seems like there might be a high probability on a risk-adjusted rate of return that you gentlemen would like to continue on to these actual numbers where you start to illustrating what you're trying to tell us, sort of. my question is a little bit at a higher level. In terms of doing the model behind this POB approach, it's probably a given that the department and others in administration are also modeling the sovereign wealth concept at the same time from a blended rate of risk adjusted rate of return for the state. So I think I'm asking a pretty obvious question, but I'll give you an opportunity to yay or nay that one.
Representative Munoz.
Mr. Burnett, did you have a response?
Through the chair to Representative Edgemon, you can, yes, it's being modeled by the other ones being modeled. We have very very robust model for the Sovereign Wealth Fund bill, and this one we've had a lot of modeling done by our investment banks that show us what we can do.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up. Just to extend that line of questioning just a step further, then would Alaska be the one sovereign entity that would have this much sort of probabilities attached to the equity markets? Given we would have this amount in our retirements and, of course, the Sovereign Wealth Fund, presuming that happens.
Through the chair to Representative Edgemon, I'm not positive what the answer is to that because I'm not sure how large some other funds are, like retirement funds are, relative to the size of their population and government. But we would certainly have a large exposure relative to most places, you know, given the size of our population, yes.
Yeah, and I think that goes without saying. Thank you.
Okay, I think
Representative Moon had a question on that point.
So thank you. Related. So we were facing in 2014 a situation where the retirement was one of our fastest growing debts, you know, portions of our budget, and we had to really address that to bring that cost down. So now we're at a payment level that's somewhat sustainable. I mean, we went, as you said, from close to $1 billion down to roughly $250 million, I think, and if we're on a 20-year payoff. If we were to go with this route, what would happen to the amount that we owe roughly annually, and how long would that debt be compared to where we're at now?
Through the chair to Representative Munoz, when we get a little farther into the presentation, that's exactly what we're going to show.
Right.
But to that point, even after you adjusted the payments with the $3 billion deposit, still used a amortization model that has rapidly rising payments into the future. And that's the other part of what we're trying to look at as we go here. So I'll go through this page really quickly, really, really quickly, so we can get on to the rest of the presentation. The option here is to fund, that we're looking at is to fund TERS to 90%, which is about $675 million additional contribution, fund PERS to eliminate state contributions above the 22% of payroll, somewhere between $1.1 billion and $1.8 billion. We don't want to use long-term savings to avoid short-term payments, which other states have done, like New Jersey or Illinois. We don't want to be like them. We want to use the savings to reduce the projected increases in future payments because we don't want to leave a bigger payment for the future, especially if in a downward trending revenues situation. We want to take advantage of low interest rates, historically low rates. And the stock market has undergone a couple of corrections this year, and if we implement a strategy on the reinvestment side to allow for dollar cost average or otherwise limiting our risk of buying into an overvalued market. So I'm going to let Devin take over from here, our debt manager.
So on page 6, then, we have a depiction of the current approach where the state makes annual payments to the pension funds, and then the proposal that for a portion of that UAAL that the state make a deposit to the pension funds to satisfy that portion of the UAAL and then replace it with a periodic payment to investors, as Jerry said earlier, just changing who we make our payments to. On the next page, we have the breakout on the four TERS, and these are the new valuation numbers. And so we've been working with Buck, the actuary, to come up with these different scenarios to try to provide analysis both for ourselves and now for you. And it's been a bit of a struggle, and apologize again for our inability to have more information available, but there's I'm sure you understand that I'm sure you do, there's a process and people are reluctant to change their processes, and we're dealing with that as well.
But in any event, you can see the employer's contribution, the non-state employers for TERS from 2016 at $21.2 million, building to about $25 million in 2038 and then declining in 2039. The state, as an employer, makes a relatively small contribution because we're not a large TERS employer. And then the state contribution in the blue is the state payment on behalf of the system that holds the system employers harmless at the 11.56% rate. And so you can see that grows from the $130.1 million in 2016 to about $265 million by 2039. And that's in part what we're talking about focusing on.
So, Mr. Mitchell, Burnett, since this assumes an 8% actuarial rate, it goes out 25 years. If we went back 25 years, if we averaged 8%?
Mr. Chair, yes, we actually averaged more than 8% over the last 25 years.
Just through the chair, what's the ER non-rate? What's ER stand for?
It's the employer rate, non-state.
And that, thank you. So I understand the relationship between the state and the non-state. So what is the employer rate?
It's percentage? 12.56. 12.56,
okay.
Representative Wilson?
Yeah, this is just TERS, and then PERS is the next page.
Okay, good. Cite that, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in what you're modeling, is the only risk that we won't do the 8% and we will end up paying an additional amount? Because right now you're telling us we're doing this because we'll get the 8%, we're going to get the money at a cheaper rate, and therefore that will keep our payment steady unless we don't get the 8%.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, as Jerry said earlier, if we don't get the 8%, we're going to have to pay more in either scenario. The idea with the pension obligation bond is that we're paying on so we have an amount that should have been placed into the retirement system currently for employees' benefits that have already accrued, and that amount is deficient by some amount. Let's say in TERS, it's $1.4 billion. And that $1.4 billion, if you amortize that out over 23 years at 8%, equals a much larger number. If you amortize that at 5%, that's what we're talking about, or some portion of that at 5%, then you're going to realize a savings over that 23-year period because you're only paying at 5% instead of at 8%.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
So is the risk then if it goes under the 5%? Our return?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, over that 23-year period, for the POBs in isolation, not considering the TERS system in aggregate, yes.
Thank you.
On the next page, we have the same information that we had for TERS, but for PERS, so that you have the employer rate for the non-state employers, 118.8 million in 2016, building to 272.3 million in 2039, and that's based on that 22% of payroll. And then the state as an employer in the next column, 132.1, building to 302.9, and then the state contributions that hold that rate at 22%. With 126.5 in fiscal year 2016. There's actually reductions in the short term, and that's in part because of the deposit of the $1 billion into PERS in addition to some other actuarial gyrations that I won't try to explain because actuarial science is in some ways, I mean, black magic. It takes a long time for them to do stuff, and they have very complex calculations that they do trying to determine a lot of future events that are very difficult to predict. But that again, that liability or that state contribution column, the blue column, then grows to $283 million by 2039. And again, that's what we're focused on, is that growth in that annual payment and trying to flatten that to the extent we can.
So, Mr. Vander, Mr. Mitchell, on the prior page, So if we look at 2016 state's contribution at $126.5 million, so under the current system we have now, according to what I'm reading here, the state's contribution next year would be 99, go down to 32, 46, 58. Is that what we're expecting now as we're developing a budget in the current system?
Because that's what it says. Mr. Chair, so this information wasn't available when the budget was developed. So I'm not sure what the FY17 budget says at this point, because as I said earlier, this information isn't normally distributed until after the legislative session. And so you're relying, and that's what external parties expect us to do, is to use the analysis and the actuarially determined contribution from last year for making this year's payment determination, even though, we're sitting here with new information. It's just that we have a mismatch, and I don't know what you do about that. That's a whole different topic, if you wanted to get into that, because it's not us that are controlling it.
Devin, I think my question meant to, as we know it right now, because it says the current unfunded liability breakdown, so I'm assuming that this, and we're trying to develop our budget.
Right. Yes.
That's what I meant by that. So as we are trying to develop our budget, when I'm looking at the state's contribution for PERS, you've got it estimated 126, so next year we expect it to be 99, and then the 32, that's, as we look at our numbers, this is what we would expect. This is your estimate of our costs.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an accurate, this is Jerry Burnett, I think that's an accurate way to look at it, is this is a likely result for next year. It's not definite, but it's in the range of where your result is, which is an improvement.
Yeah, it's great. It's better than $1 billion.
Way better.
We look at this. This is important. This is good information for the committee. Yeah.
On the next,
Representative. So, back on the previous page, just real quick. So several years ago, we were talking about $3 billion infusion. Part of the discussion that we had was it was supposed to level out our payments. We were supposed to have like $500 million payments for the entirety of the rest of the time. And it doesn't seem like that's panned out in that same capacity, that it's gonna go up. So right now, you're asking us to do these pension obligation bonds with this understanding that it's going to be flat. But if we don't bring in 8% in that particular year, would we have to cover that cost? Or would we have to pay more in that particular year? Because I think part of what's going on is it's a little bit of shell shock. We were all told we were only going to see $500 million for the next 20 years. And now we're coming back and being told that that's not the case, and we're going to have to relook at it again. So, I guess to be fair to the body, there's reason you're going to have pushback. And it's not that – I don't think anyone lied to us in any way, shape, or form. We're just trying to figure this out. We were told one thing, we're not seeing it. Help us understand what's going forward. So in this case, if we don't make the 8% actuarial rate in that particular year, let's say we bring in 7%, we miss it by 100 basis points. Are we in that particular year going to have to cover what should have been made in our estimate of 8%? So instead of it being whatever the new flat rate's going to be, we're going to have to cover the additional amount that was made. Or will we not pay that 100 basis point miss and allow it over time, because we've estimated 8% over time, will we over time find ourselves back in this situation having another discussion about having increased costs in retirement because we weren't hitting the goals that we had intended?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, this is Jerry Burnett again. The answer to that question is somewhat complicated. The actuaries use a smoothing formula, which captures the results of investments over a period of years. So you're likely not going to see that whole difference in 1 year. You're going to see that difference over a period of years if you have multiple years that are po- poor investment returns, you're going to see the unfunded liability grow and the rates go up. If you see multiple good years, it's going to go the other way. It's not going to go as fast as the difference because there's a time lag and a smoothing of assets. One of the things that the legislature did when they put the $3 billion in, one of the proposals, as I recall, was to just fix that flat fix it as a flat contribution. You didn't make that choice. But you also asked the ARM board to take smoothing out, at least for the 1 year, to allow this to catch up, you know, because you have a new massive infusion of cash, so that would be reset rather than averaging the $3 billion in over several years. And actually, I believe there's intent attached to the legislation that passed that asked it to not use smoothing for that period. And so you see a faster catch-up on or a reduction in payments here. And then payments increase over time for a number of reasons, but the biggest reason is that the actuaries assume payroll growth, and so they we're using a level percentage of pay. So it's the same percentage of pay in every year for the amortization, and if you assume that payroll is growing at a certain, like you get a growth in your payments over time on the estimates.
Go ahead.
So this page is intended to depict what we're actually talking about doing with TERS as far as how a pension obligation bond might be implemented. And so I think Jerry referred to the plan would be to fund the TERS system up to 90%, the 90% funding level. Those payments that the state's going to make on behalf of are in the first column under prior state obligation. So, for example, in 2017, it was $116.7 million. We would refund or refinance through a POB issue 75.9 million of that, and there would remain an unfunded actuarially assumed liability payment of 40.8 million. And so you'd still have some of that flexibility that Representative Munoz asked about earlier, the hard liability, soft liability. The hard liability would become the POB debt service at 48.3 million, that white column. That remains fairly static for the balance, the 23-year life. The total state payment after transaction is column E, and that.
Evan.
Yes.
Jerry, could you use a pointer something up here? Yeah. Sure. It's hard to follow. Okay. I think there's a pointer next to you there.
Yeah. Okay.
So if you could just put it on the screen, and we don't have a camera today, so either one, but.
Don't look at
it. It might be easier for members to follow what you're talking about.
So I was looking at the columns on the left. So the 116.7 is the first column, and that's the payment that we're otherwise, the state's otherwise making on behalf of the TERS employers. And then the refunded state UAAL column, the first light blue column, column B, that's the amount that's essentially being refinanced by the POB debt service. The next column is the remaining state liability that you'd still have to pay annually, and that's where I was saying there'd still be that flexibility that if things really went off the tracks and you couldn't pay something, you could still decide not to pay that and not have a credit default. The POB debt service is the white column that Jerry's on now, the 48.3 million, and then the state payment after transaction is the next column in the dark blue, the 89 million, which is reduced from the 116.7 million, and that differential is reflected in the final column, the 27.6 for FY17. So the 17.88 is the contribution rate, and the 27.6 is the difference in cash flow for each one of the years. And so we're actually talking about having a diminishment in year one and slight increases in years two, three, and four. And then you can really see the back end loading of that where it builds to $45 million in 2039. And that's by intention to try to flatten that payment curve. If you look over on the right hand, the state only chart on the upper right, there's the solid line at the top, that's what we're paying on right now. So that's the do-nothing option. And the dark blue bars below that is where we wind up if we do the POB transaction. And so the difference between the line and the bars represents savings or diminishment in payment. And there's the 17 diminishment, but then otherwise we've really tried to push those savings out to the longer end of the amortization to diminish the growth of year-over-year payments. And the debt service, the POB debt service, is reflected by that light blue layer of bars going across the bottom. And if you wanted to compare that just to the liability that it's refinancing, that's the orange line. So there's kind of a lot going on in there. And somebody asked me the other day, what if we just put cash in there and you would just chop off that POB debt service? And that's essentially what you'd wind up. So you'd chop off the blue line and diminish each one of those columns by 48.3 million. And then that would give you the resulting impact of just throwing cash in there versus borrowing the money. The impact on the total system is shown below in that bottom chart, which is, in the TERS case, is very similar to the state-only benefit, because all of the benefit accrues to the state, because we have that 12.56% contribution rate. The second column in the dark blue is the contribution rate, and you can see it hits a low of, 17% in FY17, and then builds back up to 24.39%. And so the state's always going to be providing that shock absorber function that we're in at this point as the deep pocket for the retirement system. Whenever there's a deficiency or a worse experience, the state's going to be making extra payments. If the experience of the future, let's say, they're overly conservative on health care, or life expectancy goes down, or the investments do better than the 8%, then the state's contribution would diminish from those actions as well.
So, Mr. Mitchell, here's the situation I see. Is I'm looking out 5 or 6 years from today's current date, and it seems like the state's payments would be more than they are under if we were to stay at the current system. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the states, that's what we're actually not, it's more than, a little more than 5 or 6, we go positive in 2021, so it's about 5 years, that we start accruing a benefit and from this transaction and by intention.
Where do I see in the chart the amount of estimated money the differences would be?
It's the column cash flow difference, and it's 417.5 million if you added those up.
I'm just concerned about, like, in 17, 18, 19, 20, and 21.
Those, again, by design, this particular structure is pushing savings into the future.
I understand, but Mr. Mitchell, the problem we have right now is, particularly in this year's budget, we're looking at cutting public broadcasting for 320. I mean, we're cutting to the bone on everything we've got, and I don't see where it would be an advantage for the legislature to make it so we have to pay more in payments to TERS-PERS under a system that's 80% funded. Your words, one of the best in the nation. Well, they were yours at one time. And we're trying to come up with money to just fund the very basics across Alaska. And if we have to put more money into this right now at the beginning, and I get it, at the end it would save us in the long run, but wouldn't it be better if we started this when we weren't in such a problem with debt? And then when we looked, I'll just leave it at that, and I'll get to make this. I mean, can you understand what I mean?
Mr. Chair, I mean, we'll be cash positive. I mean, you're looking at a $27.8 million reduction in the first year that more than offset the 18, 19, 20 underperformance years. If that were a goal, we can eliminate those underperformance years. The goal was to get the growth in the annual state contribution to be as close to level as possible to benefit the future rather than today. That's the most conservative thing that we could do, is worry about the future, not worry about ourselves today.
We're pretty concerned about today. And so when I look at the bond ratings, they've just downgraded us, as you're aware of. And so if we give ourselves even more debt that the state has this year and the next couple of years, wouldn't the bond rating agencies view that as probably not a good thing, to make it so that we have even more debt?
Mr. Chair, that's in part why we're suggesting this be structured the way that we are, is that it's the most conservative way of structuring it, this type of transaction. We're not banking on savings to bail us out. We're banking on savings to help us in the long run. That's a lot different than us doing what Jerry talked about earlier, what New Jersey or Illinois did, where they avoided all of year one and two's payments, banking that they were going to outperform in the long run.
I'm just very concerned about the next couple of years and the ability to try and even make what we're doing right now, and going into this one, it's going to cost us even more. It's going to put more burden on even more programs that we have across the state to try and get to a manageable level of a budget. So I'll just leave it at that and continue on, please. Representative Munoz.
Could you tell me, thank you, how the non-state employers contribute their share of the debt service? Is it on a state, the 12.5 and 22, is it the same percentages? Or
through the chair, they would not be paying any of the debt service, because their payments would not, this obligation would not reach the level of impacting the other employers. That 12.56 floor, the contribution rate, the lowest it gets is 17 point, or the employer rate, the lowest it gets is 17.88%. And so you're still more than 5% above that floor of the employer contribution rate.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Munoz. Representative Thompson.
I didn't quite get that last statement there. Pension obligation bonds that are being proposed, do they address the on-behalf payments that the state makes for the municipalities?
Through the chair, a portion of it. That's what the column A represents, the on-behalf payments that the state is making above the 12.56%,
right,
that the employers are making. So the employers are making their. So if we flip back two slides, the employers are paying in 2017 $26.7 million.
Right.
The state is paying, on behalf of the employers, $116.7 million.
And then show up the PERS one.
What's that?
Next.
One forward. And that's the same relationship, where the non-state employers are paying $132 million in 17, and the state contribution is
$99 million. Okay. Yeah. So this pays a portion of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
On the TERS, that's outside the formula?
Mr. Chair, the state contribution on behalf is outside the formula. The 12.56 would be paid within the...
It's additional money outside the education fund.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, thank you. I can follow this pretty easy. I think I can see from the left-hand column to the right-hand column, and I think I get what this is trying to tell us. But just a sort of a nitpicky question, going back to the sort of the employment patterns, the actual aerial analysis, what does your model base the number of state employees on? Right now there's 25,000-some state employees. If we cut a couple thousand out, that's going to take a little bit of air out of this model somewhere. What number do you use?
Through the chair to Representative Edgman, the actuaries are using the actual employment numbers and working from that. But as you say, should there be a reduction in state employees or non-state employees, the amount paid through the employer contribution is going to be less, and the amount paid on behalf is going to be more. over time, I would expect your liabilities to be reduced in the system, depending on where the people were in their employment at the time they were they left. But in the short run, the liabilities aren't going to change very much, so it's going to shift costs from the employer rate to the state on behalf payment.
So through the chair, you could probably order up actuarial analysis with different employee numbers fairly easily?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman, I'm not sure that would be easy, and it certainly wouldn't be cheap, but it's possible to examine this based on different types of numbers, but it's not quick, and it does cost money every time we run an actuarial analysis.
Okay.
Jerry, can we just get an idea? I mean, you've both been doing this a long time without mm-hmm. spending a lot of other money on getting a full, complete
right.
actuarial. Could you give us, in your best estimate, the information that Representative Edgeman asked for?
Mr. Chair, I think we can go back to the department and see if we can do that. What if we don't have employer growth and if there are reductions in the number of employees? That's what you're asking for, right?
Okay. Thanks. I think that would help. Representative Garrett, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thanks. I mean, I have a lot of the concerns that folks have mentioned, but I guess the one positive, the one immediate positive is under your plan, I guess if you measure the first 4 years, it makes us more cash positive than the current system. So we save $27 million the first year, if you're right, and then pay an additional $7 million over the next 3 years. So if we banked some of that $25 million the first year, we'd have a little bit of extra money over the next few years. I get that. But I guess I'm with Representative Pruitt. I don't get these out years where we're paying in total more than $250 million a year when the whole promise when we put the $3 billion into the system was that we would level out at $250 million a year, and now we're being told that wasn't a promise.
Through the chair to Representative Garrett, I believe that there's actual direction to the retirement board to use level percent of payroll rather than level dollar amortizations. If you had a level dollar amortization, you'd have more dollars in the current year and fewer in the out year, and it could be level on an amortization. Using a level percent of pay, which is how the actuaries have come to these numbers, is what causes that change over time.
Thanks. Through the chair.
Who decides that, Jerry?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to go back because I'm not sure if it's in the statute, and
thanks.
I believe it is.
I think it was
put in the statute when you actually passed the statute last time.
Representative Garrett?
Yeah, through the chair. I mean, I guess the problem is it's possible that this is a good cost savings idea if we take the risk, but the problem is the sort of noise that's coming with the presentation, which is at least many of us walked out. I mean, among all the other things you've heard today, at least like Representative Pruitt said before, at least many of us walked out of the session where we put $3 billion in on the retirement system seeing this chart that said we were going to level out the actual payments to $250 million a year. And so the noise is, I think, what's in part causing us to be not so happy at all. I know we have to look at the proposal on the merits, not on the presentation on the noise, but the noise is causing a problem, I think.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I understand your concerns, and I believe that what happened is there were presentations made during that session, and then the final version of the bill would not match the presentations that were made earlier.
Did any of us know that, Mr. Chair?
Representative,
yeah. Mr. Chair, did any of us know that? My recollection was it was a flat $250 million payment. Nobody ever came to me and said it wasn't.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Munoz was pretty familiar with the issue at that time.
Thank you. Yes, it was roughly $250 million for the first 10 or 15 years, and then it went up to approximately $500 million in the very end years. Mm-hmm. But those were numbers that we had, all of the committee members had. And they're very similar to what is shown, the same numbers that we have here today in this presentation. Not in this graph, but in a previous graph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Though this presentation has it way below 250 the first couple of years and then much higher. It doesn't matter.
Mr. Chairman, at this point. The combined, if you look at both the TERS and the PERS, the combined is roughly $250 million.
If you're right, I didn't add it that way, but it doesn't matter. That's the noise. That doesn't matter.
So, Mr. Burnett, and I forgot which statute, where the statute is, if it's level pay and amortization or payment. Is it worth looking at, if we change the statute the other way, how it would affect our payments to the state?
Mr. Chair, it's certainly worth looking at. It would cause a significant increase in the current year's actuarially required contribution. So but it would level it out significantly more in the future.
Maybe you could get us that information if you could, Jerry. It's okay. Just on paper. As long as we're looking at it, changes this way. Let's investigate everything so we don't end up like 2009. Representative Wilson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's not really assuring that we know that we're here in a presentation, might make a decision, and then find out the decision we made was not based on the presentation. So I hope that doesn't happen. I guess my curiosity of what we did on the $3 billion, I know that the Senate changed the allocations of the $2 and the $1 million, if I remember correctly, that I think the House was having it go one direction and the Senate went the other way. And maybe that's why you're correct, that the presentation we heard and what we did out of the House was not the same as what the Senate did, because I know I got blasted at home over and over again for that change in the Senate that I didn't catch until after we voted on it. So I would hope, Mr. Chair, that we will, if this presentation isn't what goes forward because somebody changes something, that we hear that before the final vote.
Mr. Chairman,
Jerry. It goes the other way around, from Senate over to the House.
Yeah, that's what. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, the Senate changed it and sent it back to the House, correct? Yeah, that's what I meant to say if I didn't say it, and that wasn't explained to us at the last minute, and it did change, I think, what the municipalities thought and definitely what I thought, and I did pay for it later.
Okay, we still got 7 or 8 pages left to go, so go ahead.
So on this page, we have some information about the structuring of the proposed transaction. And to be clear, again, we've talked about some of these numbers, and I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. These are numbers that we expect we could achieve today if we were given direction to proceed with this structure in this market. But there's a lag between today and when we would actually be able to implement this transaction. And so we're at the risk of market changes, and we're at the risk of, I think there should be clear direction on structure if this committee is interested in a specific structure, that you should make clear on the record that you're interested in that structure and what it would be. So my two cents.
I think we made clear we want all the information on all the options.
Right? Yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And so on this page we have a proposed structure where we have a fixed rate, and this is, again, TERS, to hit the funding target of 90%. That total borrowing amount is $675.9 million, $506.9 million being fixed rate bonds, a variable rate position of $169 million, which is 25% of that total, and the total deposit being $672.5 million, refinancing that unfunded actuarially assumed liability at a true interest cost, of 4.4%. With an all-in cost of 4.5%. And so you can see the average annual payment reduction is $18.1 million. And again, down below, it shows the gross cash flow difference of $417.5 million, that if you present value that
becomes $223 million in today's dollars. Or what we normally do in my world, if you're refinancing a debt, you say, what's the savings on the refunded bonds? And for an advance refunding, you might be at 5% present value savings, and we're looking at 33% here, which if you were refinancing debt and could hit 33%, everybody would be high-fiving. That would be an extraordinary transaction. And again, the cash flow differences are shown on the right-hand column.
Just real quick.
Representative, and gentlemen, we got 15 minutes to get through this. We need to stick to the most pertinent information if we can.
I just want to ask, just real quick, the thought process on the variable. I mean, we're kind of in a low interest rate environment. What just the thinking behind a variable for a quarter of it?
We have an allowance through the chair. We have an allowance in our debt policy to have up to 25% of a portfolio variable. The variable position at this point in time would have an extraordinarily low interest rate, all in around 1%. And so it has a positive impact. You are taking a risk. That's why the variable rate is a smaller component, that interest rates go up or our credit quality deteriorates. And in both of those instances, you would expect your rate to increase. In our analysis, we assumed that the rate would go up every year by 0.5% until it hit 4%. And so we start off at current rates, and then we assumed it would go up 0.5% next year, the year after, until it hit 4%, and then it would be static at 4%, which would be a relatively historically high variable rate for the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Mitchell, Representative Thompson has a few questions. It might be part of the other more parts of the presentation, but I want to make sure he has an opportunity to ask his questions.
Devin, I'm curious, looking at the future, what's the state's bonding capacity? And to follow along with that, where are we right now as far as being able to bond from going from pre-feed to feed? If we had to bond $9 to $11 billion next spring, where are we with our bonding capacity and ability, and is this going to affect it?
Mr. Chair, it's a good question. The state's debt capacity, we have a debt affordability analysis that we do annually. Inside of that, it has these numbers, $175 million of general obligation capacity, and on other state-supported debt, a $225 million capacity using our historical metrics of unrestricted revenue. And on GEO debt, not wanting to have our debt service, our annual debt service, to be more than 5% of our unrestricted revenue, and for all state-supported debt, not wanting it to be more than 8% of unrestricted revenue. There's talk afoot that there could be changes in how the state counts unrestricted revenue, and that would have result in a change in, I think, our methodology perhaps for the affordability analysis, because our percentages are based on recognition that our primary source of revenue is an extremely volatile commodity. And so they're maybe lower than they otherwise could be if our annual revenue was a little more stable like some other states enjoy. And so it's kind of a difficult question at the end of the day. Any debt that you issue in this environment, you should be carefully considered. The POB transaction is a little different because it's already a liability that's on our books, and so we're in essence refinancing an existing debt. But it's still something that we need to approach carefully and make sure that we are careful with educating any credit analysts or investors that are looking at the state. And then when you jump over to the natural gas pipeline potential financing, that's a heavy lift for our state based on the projections of revenue that we have at this time. You'd be looking at a multi-time increase in the amount of outstanding state-supported debt, and it would have almost inevitably, if we were going to borrow for that, a negative impact on our credit rating.
I don't know how you avoid that, because you're going to, it's just like, as an individual, if you have higher debt metrics, you have a lower credit score. If we have higher debt ratios, if we've leveraged ourselves further, we're going to have an expectation of a diminished credit rating.
Representative Tom,
I think I got an answer out of that.
So specifically on that point, so every step that the state takes to get closer to getting in-state gas pipeline, where we would have a secure revenue source, we'd have 20% equity in a $60 billion project, that's a definite advantage to the state.
In the long term, it's an advantage. In the short term, it's a liability, because it doesn't start generating cash until it's done. And we would have no ability to finance it with project finance without a state guarantee until it's done.
Again, so every step that the state takes to reduce its yearly budget, every chance the state takes to show that we've taken steps to level out the amount of income that's coming to the state and reduce the volatility is a benefit?
As I understand it, yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
The shortest answer all day.
On this page, we have the same information we had for TERS, but for PERS, and so you can see the prior state obligation in column A, the 99.2 million. We would, in this scenario, refinance all of that through a POB debt service column that is at just under 72 million. The state payments after the transaction equal debt service, because it essentially eliminates the payments on behalf of for a period of time through 2029. The maybe unfortunate thing about that, depending on your perspective, is if you look over at the total contribution rate, which is the contribution rate, the second one in the dark blue, to the left, that one, yeah. So if you look at that total contribution rate, it goes from 22% in 2017 to 20.56% in 2018. That's the employer contribution rate that both the state and the non-state employers would pay. So you'd actually be giving a benefit in that instance to not just the state's budget, but also to all of the employers' budget. So it's, and this is the nature of how PERS is constructed at this point, that and that we've gone back and forth with Buck on this, and they say they can't hold the contribution rate for the employers at 22% if you make a deposit that would, in their view, require it to be driven below 22%. So in this scenario, we have a state benefit in 2017 of $27 million, again, in the interest of trying to have as level a debt service schedule as possible. That number goes negative, and more negative than the positive of 2017 in 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, and 24. And then we start accruing benefit, and there's a total cash flow benefit of $505 million over the long term with a $221 million present value. This is an area that I personally have struggled a little bit, because I do think, I mean, Representative Guerra was talking about the deal that was struck a couple of years ago, and if there were a way to hold the contribution rate for employers at 22%, I think that you could. And we don't have these numbers, unfortunately, because we haven't been able to get Buck to run them. But we could further eliminate that resurgence of the state contribution on behalf of, or potentially eliminate it altogether, so that we could get to a point where maybe this is a transaction of, what, $1.17 billion that gets us to this point, and maybe we do $1.3 billion, and then we hold employer contribution at 22%, and then we don't have a state payment on behalf of anymore. We just have annual debt service, which would be a desirable goal, but I think requires meddling with the statutes. So anyway, the charts on the right, I think, are fairly self-explanatory based on our past discussion with TERS. the black line being the current payment requirement, and that being replaced by the debt service, the light blue, and then the bar chart, the dark blue and light blue, and the out years. And so, again, you see all the benefit, or the majority of the benefit, being pushed to those out years, where you see those, you know, in the final year, budgetary relief of almost $72 million. The total system is shown in the bottom, and some of the benefit actually accrues to the total system. So on the next page, I think we show that. Whoops, went the wrong way there. I didn't go. There you go. And so you can see the partial refund of the state contribution generating a par amount in the state-only UAAL comparison of $1.8 billion, with, again, the fixed rate and variable rate assumption, term of 23 years, the deposit, the UAAL impact, and the TIC, and average payment reductions. Boy, I'm looking for what I was looking for, and I'm not seeing it. So I might need to get back to you with I know what this does. So you can see the state-only comparison is column one, and if you go to that average annual payment reduction line, Jerry, which is under the summary statistics, that one up from there, or three up from there, the next little section, yeah, that 21.986, that's the state's benefit on an annual basis. The 28.593 is the total benefit. And so just under $6.5 million of the benefit is accruing to the municipalities or the other employers in the PERS system each and every year during the life of this partial refund of the state contribution. If you jump over to the full refund, which would be that $1.8 billion number, and that's if you didn't want to make another state payment on behalf of the employers, it actually makes the state benefit negative because the benefit's actually accruing to the other employers. So it's a nonsensical transaction from the state-only's perspective, even though it generates $1.383 billion of savings. They don't accrue to the state of Alaska. They accrue to... Okay, never mind.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gary had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand... I guess somebody probably pointed this out while I took my walk, but the page numbers are not helpful.
Yeah.
On the TERS chart of how much this would save us or cost us in the first few years, and you probably understand we're very concerned about the next few years. On the TERS chart, we save $27 million in the first year, costs us $7 million more over the next 3 years in total, so net we may save $20 million over the first 4 years. I understand the PERS chart, or the TERS chart. I don't get which one of these is the corresponding PERS chart. I don't know which numbers to look at. So where is the number of how much extra we will save or lose in the first 5 years under the PERS part of this if we adopted your proposal?
Those numbers, right?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Garrett, would be the same column, the cash flow difference.
So that's page 8.
Oh, no, I'm
through
fascinated
the chair.
By that.
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Yeah. Through the chair, then.
Notice Department of Revenue, the pages aren't numbered.
I noticed that as well, sorry. There was some cutting and pasting going on in the presentation.
Oh, if you can count to 10.
We can't count that.
I think you can.
I got two.
Go ahead, Rep.
Through the chair, so the last column, that's in millions. So in 2017, the right column, that's 27.1 million. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so in the TERS portion of the system, in the first 5 years, we, under your assumptions, it would come out $20 million positive over the first 1, 2, 3, 4 years. But under the TERS system, we come out like over $50 million negative in the first 5 years. And so since we're paying both PERS and TERS, it seems to me in the first 5 years, even if everything works the way you assume, it's going to cost us more over the first 5 years once you combine PERS and TERS. And if I'm right about that, I don't see how we afford that right now. And so tell me.
through the chair, Representative Garrett, it's by design. As I said at the outset, we were given direction to try to come up with as level a structure as possible, and so that's why you have the dis savings in the short term. As we talked a minute ago about what's the expectation of our required payment under the revised valuation, and they go down. There are savings from the prior years, and then they go right back up. This fills in that void, and keeps payments more static. If, again, there's direction that we should not be doing that in the short term, that we're not wanting to have this savings in any particular year, we can structure this so that it accomplishes that goal.
Through the chair, just one last question.
Representative Gare.
Under the TERS system part of it, over the life, we save $417 million. For the PERS part, where's the over the life savings? What is that?
It's in that same column, the $505.7 million. Whoops.
That.
That's not. That's
to the top.
A different.
Oh, it's the top on this one.
Yeah, this is the scenario where that we refinance the entire obligation, the $1.8 billion. But we're not suggesting we do this. This was more just for illustrative purposes. If you go back to that slide, it's $505.7 million. Yeah. So did you? So that's where you said you lost me. That because the percentage of payroll goes down when the funding level goes up, it's not held static at 22%. The state pays more in the long run because the other employers aren't contributing as much to the system. And so every year they don't contribute as much, it means the state has to contribute more in the back end. So.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
That's what you said last time.
I know.
Representative Guerra.
I know. But you don't believe any of us when we say that, right?
Representative Guerra.
So that $505 million savings you've said is one we shouldn't expect because it's a scenario that's unlikely?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. No, this is a scenario that works out to generate that level of savings. It does not eliminate the payment on behalf of requirement that the state currently has. You see it coming back in 2029. That's what I'm talking about. And you also see in the column labeled total contribution rate, which is the second dark blue column, that contribution rate goes below 22%. So our partners, the municipalities, pay less than 22% from 2018 through 2029 in this scenario.
And if I could add just one thing to that, the state as an employer also pays less than 22% under this scenario, which is not a benefit to the state, particularly when we're paying on the other end, particularly because the payments as an employer are coming out of fund sources other than general fund in some cases. So
I'll take up the last question. So what is the combined TERS, PERS, if we were to implement the plan this year, what's the combined TERS, PERS further cost to the state? I mean, how much additional funds would it cost the state?
Mr. Chairman, it wouldn't cost the state any additional funds.
Not this year.
Or next year?
If the direction of the committee is that there shall not be dis-savings in any year, that shall be implemented, and there will be no increase in cost in any year from the projections that are provided today.
And your projections for this fiscal year, are they in Governor Walker's current budget?
No, they are not, because this information just came out in late January, this new valuation, and as we said earlier, hasn't been finalized, and so Governor Walker's budget is still based on last year's valuation, which
savings,
has
expected savings are not in this year's budget either.
Right.
Representative Thompson. Yeah. Next calendar.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, the House Finance Committee will meet next on Monday, February 15th, 2016, at 1:30 p.m. Next week, we're going to be taking up permanent fund bills. On Monday, we'll hear House Bill 245 again, permanent fund deposits, dividends, and earnings. That's at 1:30 on Monday.
Thank you, members. With that, we'll adjourn.
Pages should be numbered.